Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. And don't forget to wear your mask. And you can still shop online at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That beautiful music is by Johann Sebastian Bach, and it is the opening to the third of his six Brandenburg Concertos, the Concerto No. 3 in G major. This wonderful work is on the program for a concert that is going to be played this coming Saturday, the 10th of October, by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. And even in the constrictions imposed on all of us by the COVID-19 pandemic, the Kenosha Symphony wants to find a way to move forward and still offer music to the community. And this concert is going to be one way to do that. And on the phone with me is Thea Keshavarzi, who is the president of the Kenosha Symphony Board and someone who plays in the Kenosha Symphony as well. And she's going to be joining us to tell us a little bit about the conversations that have occurred at the Kenosha Symphony and with their music director in terms of how to move forward and how to stay safe, even as they try to continue to offer music up to Kenosha. Thea Keshavarzi, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
So first of all, it might be good for us to just kind of remind everybody, although it's not a fun thing to relive, but relive what occurred back in the spring when the curtain of COVID-19 descended on the community as it descended all over the state and the country and the world for that matter, and how the Kenosha Symphony's last season was truncated. And as I recall, it was at somewhat the last minute that that call was finally made that the concert that was scheduled for Reuther High School Auditorium could not go forward. Can you just remind us about that sort of sad circumstance which necessitated the canceling of the remainder of that season?
Yes. For obvious reasons, we were not able to perform our March concert, which was a Broadway concert. We could not use Reuther. We could not gather at that time. At that time, we had decided to postpone it till June, but we were actually had to cancel that concert also, and we also had to cancel our May concert. But since then, and going forward, we have done a lot of soul searching and a lot of thinking. And this year, our season is our music, our soul. And since the lights went out last March, the musicians have struggled with the loss of performing with other musicians. And there's a hole in our souls. No one knows when the orchestra will be able to come together again. But the KSO has worked tirelessly and creatively to uphold our commitment to keep live music in the community. And this includes presentations with smaller groups of musicians. I know that the absence of live music has left a hole in the souls of audience members also. COVID-19 has left us feeling isolated. Along with dealing with COVID-19, Kenosha has also been through an enormous loss with the shooting of Jacob Blake and the destruction that followed. Music lifts our spirits and gathers us together and helps heal hurting souls, just what we need in this time of social isolation, fear, and loss. I know that the musicians are looking forward to this concert on Saturday night, and I hope that people will come to the Kemper Center to join us in music making.
So tell us a little bit about the conversations that have, and then we'll get to what's going to be happening Saturday night, but I think it would be interesting to just know a little bit about the sort of conversations that have occurred with the board and with your artistic director, Bob Hasty, in terms of different alternatives and what makes sense and what can we do safely and so on. I mean, what has the discussion been like, and has it been difficult to, in a sense, come together with a possibility that everybody feels good about?
Sure. We've done a lot of research on types of music that we can make. Bob Hasty, fortunately, being with Northwestern, has access to all the research that's been done, and we know that we can't perform with winds at this time or singers. So the board, along with Dr. Hasty, talked over the summer and about what we possibly could do safely. And at this time, it's small chamber groups. We are going concert by concert. We will see how Saturday night goes at the Kemper Center. We know that musicians will have to be socially distanced on the stage, and the audience will also have to be socially distanced. And that's why we can only have 75 people in the audience. But we are committed to keeping the presence of the Kenosha Symphony live, even during this difficult time, in one form or another. We will be, for those people who can't attend the concert for health reasons, and we want to be able to reach out to all of our patrons, so we are going to live stream the concert on the KSO YouTube site. But I have been committed. I mean, in my heart of hearts, I know how important music is, and the board knows how important it is, and we are doing everything that we can to keep music alive in Kenosha in whatever form is safe for all the performers and the audience members.
Explain the choice of Kemper Center for the location of this particular concert. Did any particular considerations go into that choice?
Well, actually, we cannot use Reuther. No outside groups are allowed in the high school this year. And we tossed around the idea of using Carthage College or UW Parkside, and the same restrictions are with the colleges. We thought, as a chamber group, maybe it would be good to have use one of the local churches, but we were unable to do that, and the Kemper Center has invited us to use their auditorium, and we are thrilled to be able to gather there.
It's quite a beautiful... Frankly, go ahead.
It was about the only place that we could find that would have groups together.
It's a beautiful space, and I know at least in the past, it has been a space that the Kenosha Symphony has used from time to time, especially for certain fundraisers and so on. I'm thinking back a ways, but it's a lovely space in order to make music, and it sounds like it's going to work well. So this is, as we want to reiterate, an opportunity for people to come and enjoy the Kenosha Symphony sitting in the audience, but also it can be enjoyed via live streaming on the Kenosha Symphony's YouTube channel. We're speaking with Tia Keshavarsi, who is the president of the Kenosha Symphony Board and a member of the Kenosha Symphony, a member of the cello section. And we are talking about a concert that will be presented this Saturday night at Kemper Center. 75 tickets will be sold for this performance. So explain to our listeners the kind of repertoire that is going to be part of Saturday night's concert and some of the considerations that went into these choices.
Sure. We're actually using a chamber group of just 14 musicians, all string players. And we have a diverse program. We're starting with the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, which you played a little bit of. We have a soloist, a violin soloist, Yang Lee, who will be performing the Rondo and the Polonaise in B-flat major for violin by Franz Schubert. With the group, we will also be performing the Benjamin Britten Simple Symphony, which isn't actually so simple, but... and we will have a performance of Puccini's Chrysanthemum in memory of the lives lost in Kenosha due to COVID-19. And we will end the program with Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag. Dr. Hasty is very committed this season to present on each program that we do music by a black composer. So that's how we will end the program that night.
Very good. I happen to be very fond of that piece by Puccini, I Chrysanthemi, or Chrysanthemum, which I think, technically speaking, is a piece for string quartet. And there's not a lot of things that Puccini wrote that aren't operas or operatic music, but that's one of them. And it's quite exquisite, quite poignant, and what a beautiful choice to play as we think about what this community has been through. So explain then the ways in which you are going to be taking care that the audience that comes to hear the concert in person Saturday night will be safe.
Yes, we are selling all of our tickets online, so there'll be no passing back of credit cards and money and you know, paper between anyone, and there'll be no gatherings or groups of people. The performers and the audience members are required to wear masks at all times. Temperatures will be taken at the door. And we've decided that there will be no intermission, so we won't have groups gathering. The chairs are spaced out, socially distanced, and we will be at the end of the program. Ushers will be ushering the rows out in a sequential order so that people will not be able to gather in groups, and which is what we're trying to avoid. We are being as careful as we can possibly be, I believe. We're committed to having a safe and a healthy concert.
It sounds like you have thought through much of this in very careful fashion, and I'm sure many, many people deeply appreciate that care and caution. If people want more information about Saturday evening's concert, where should they go?
First, I want to mention, we haven't mentioned yet that the concert is at 7:30.
Right, yes.
Yeah. And you can go on the Kenosha Symphony website, which is kenoshasymphony.org, to purchase tickets and get information. You can also go to our Facebook page to purchase tickets and get information.
Very good. Tia Keshavarsi is the president of the Kenosha Symphony Board. We appreciate your time, and we appreciate this opportunity to hear live music. And we wish you and all of your colleagues with the Kenosha Symphony the very, very best. And thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you.
Music from the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 in G Major of Johann Sebastian Bach, which will be on the program for Saturday night's concert at Kemper Center, presented by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. The following interview comes from the Morning Show archives. It was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2012. We spend most of today's morning show speaking with Marilyn Yalom, the author of a truly fascinating book which examines the way in which the French have spoken of and written about and portrayed on stages love, how love plays out beautifully and happily and sometimes tragically and in ways fraught with complication. Marilyn Yalom is a former professor of French and a senior scholar at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. And, of course, anyone interested in gender roles and those complexities is obviously going to find incredibly fertile ground to explore in this particular topic, explored in this book. Marilyn Yalom has a number of other books to her credit, including A History of the Breast, A History of the Wife, and Birth of the Chess King. And we're going to be speaking now about this book, which is called How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance. This is published by Harper Perennial, available now in paperback. And Marilyn Yalom, we welcome you to the morning show.
I'm glad to be here.
I am so happy to be exploring this book, a book which I must confess I am still finishing. But one of the things that it makes me realize, and I think there are probably some listeners who will identify with what I'm about to say, is that this book is full of names which I recognize, and yet names that are, for me, mostly names. And I'm not a terribly read person, but on the other hand, I'm not all that well read that I really know, for instance, who Balzac was or what he wrote and many of the other very familiar names in this book. And I am so glad to know more about the stories of these various writers and playwrights and so on. I wonder if you could just sketch for our listeners a sense of what brought you into this arena in the first place. What drew you, first of all, to the wonderful world of literature and theater, and then ultimately to the French specifically?
Well, I have been interested in French culture ever since I was a teenager and was studying French and French poetry and literature at that time. I had the good fortune of spending my junior year in France and going to graduate school and ultimately becoming a French professor, which I did for quite a number of years before I turned my attention to what we called women's studies then. And certainly the history of love in France is a way of looking at French society through the lens of love, literature, history, culture, and certainly, if I were writing, when I was writing a book, I wanted one that would be attractive to Americans. And one thing sure is that Americans have not lost their fascination with French love and lovers. I mean, we go to see a French movie because we know that we're going to see the intimate space between lovers. And most recently, the film Amour, which won the Academy Award for the Best Foreign Film, which certainly showed us another face of love, that between two octogenarians after the wife has had a stroke. And that is an amazing film, unusual in the intimacy of the care that takes place between the husband and the wife. So there's so many aspects of this subject that I had an embarrassment of riches in
right.
writing about it.
You highlight two very basic points in the note to the reader at the very start of the book, which I think are worth highlighting right off the bat. a couple of facets of French culture and French attitudes that might be part of why we find ourselves so drawn to French works of this topic. One of them you talk about is that the French have always had what you characterize as a forthright insistence on sexual pleasure. I mean, there is no beating around the bush when it comes to this. And are you suggesting that this is uniquely French, I mean, in terms of this sort of forthrightness or the centrality of this versus what we would see in the literature of other cultures, for instance?
Well, I certainly think it's somewhat different from the Anglo-American tradition. The French are unabashedly forward in their acceptance of the sensual and the sexual. And it's hard for them to imagine what was asked in a survey, whether true love can exist without a radiant sex life. And the French answer to that question was resoundingly no, it can't. About 80-some percent of the respondents said that, whereas about a third of the American respondents were willing to accept true love without a radiant sex life. So there you have a pretty remarkable statistical difference, with a greater emphasis perhaps on the emotional and even the transcendent and the spiritual quality of love, whereas the French believe that love is embedded in the flesh and they make no bones about it.
Hmm. And you write a little later in this same foreword, love simply does not have the same moral overlay that we Americans expect it to have. And in other words, and you spell some specifics out, that when we read French literature or see French theater on this topic, the darker elements, the underside, the underbelly, will often be explored again with more freedom and almost with a relish that is maybe a bit alien to us.
Well, that's a very interesting commentary. I would say that the French accept the fact that love, and particularly passionate love, it may entail jealousy, multiple partners, rupture, even violence. They have a sense that love has its own justification, and that, as one famous writer said, love has reasons that defy the heart, defy reason, excuse me, so that the heart has its reasons. And there they're talking about the heart, and certainly the heart, which represents the emotions, is involved. One could not think of love as simply a sexual relationship. That would be the current that you call libertinage in French history, and that certainly is there, the idea of serial relations based upon sex. But it always is opposed to true love or permanent love or devotion, love that is a combination of sex and sentiment.
One factor or feature of your book, which I really appreciate, is the fact that there is this very interesting and I think very effective combination between your analysis of writers dating back to the Middle Ages, overlaid with contemporary stories from your own life and, for instance, maybe from the stories of people you have known, friends in your own circle, and the way in which they have, maybe you or they have lived out or experienced certain things that in some way might be a reflection of some of what you analyze. I wonder, as you first began writing this book, did it always have those, in a sense, two tiers?
No, and you're very astute in asking that question. I had no intention of putting myself in the book.
This was to be, like all of the rest of my books, a serious study, though I wanted to make it accessible and in places even lighthearted. But as I began to write, I put in some of my personal observations, and my editor at HarperCollins, who saw those observations, asked for more of them. So it ended up being what the novelist Diane Johnson said was an endearing memoir. Well, in part. I mean, I would say that's probably only a tenth of the book. And it's also interesting that my readers, for the most part, have loved the personal aspects. However, there is also the reader, and I see this on the Amazon commentaries, there's also the reader who doesn't like the personal anecdotes. However, it's usually about 1 out of 10 of the readers. So, yes, I do put myself in the book, my observations, even my opinions in places. And I hope it makes the book more appealing and more immediate for the readers. You never know. As a writer, you never know before the book is out there what kind of response it's going to get.
Well, it certainly made a positive difference as far as I'm concerned in reading your book, and I can see how it would for other people as well, particularly for people who might be relative newcomers to the whole notion of, for instance, exploring fine literature over the course of many centuries. I mean, that's, for some of us, a pretty daunting prospect. And,
I know that, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book for an American audience, thinking that at a time when French history, literature, culture are not as prominent as they once were, giving way to Latin American culture and Asian cultures, that this would be a way of presenting the France I love to an American audience. I'm pleased to know that the book is being translated into French and German and Russian and Polish and Portuguese and Chinese. I mean, I never thought that was going to happen. So, of course, I had to write a new preface for the French audience. I didn't have to explain as much.
In chapter one of the book called Courtly Love, and this is where you, of course, take us back to towards the very beginning of this 900 years that you examine. The title of the chapter is Courtly Love, How the French Invented Romance. And as you look back to the Middle Ages, your examination actually begins with a contemporary story of a friend of yours, friends actually, Marianne and Pierre. Could you just briefly say what this story is about? I mean, the story of their lives, because in a sense you find it reflective of a certain French attitude and approach to matters of the heart.
Yes, my friend was married almost 40 years ago, maybe more, and she married for a second time a man who was considerably older than she. 20 years older, and she brought two children into that marriage, and he helped to raise those children. However, at a certain point, after they had been married for maybe 10 years, I don't remember exactly, 10 or 15 years, she fell in love with a man her own age, and it was a very trying time for her. She didn't want to leave her older husband, who had been very good to her and whom she loved, but she was passionately involved with Pierre, the person I call Pierre. Well, they ultimately worked out a contract between the husband, the wife, and the lover was not present to these negotiations, whereby she could be with her lover certain hours of the week. But she stayed in the marriage until the death of her husband, and she was extremely good in taking care of him in his old age. The reason that I started the book with that is because going back to the 12th century, you have this triangle of younger wife, usually older man, usually sometimes a king, and the younger lover. You've got that in Lancelot and Guinevere, and you've got it in Tristan and Isolde. And it's a new paradigm in which the younger lover will serve the older woman. And there is often the husband to be considered. And this is a very complicated threesome. But what it does is to put the woman in the center of the relationship. And that is something that has existed in France since the Middle Ages. Also, the question of adultery. Now, in real life, it was probably the husband who strayed from the marital bed. But in fantasy, it was the woman, often married to a man who was older for reasons of property and rank rather than for love. So you're bringing love into the picture. And love is that which exists between two people who are not married. This is going to be a controversial subject throughout the 900 years of history that I write about. But in the 12th century, the time of the troubadours, the time of a medieval romance, the writers and the thinkers come down on the side of the lovers. I mean, there are these regional courts at which questions are raised about love. There are such things called love trials. Can love exist within marriage? And the attitude is generally that it cannot, because marriage is a system of obligations. So you've got this fantasy of passionate love existing outside of marriage. And the French have been dealing with that fantasy and reality for 900 years.
Mm-hmm. You explore in the second chapter of the book something a bit new in this historical progression, something called gallant lover, galanterie.
Galanterie, yes.
Yes. And what are we talking about in this interesting shift?
Galanterie is essentially a new kind of courtesy, a way of treating members of the upper sex, which is refined and which pleases the ladies. You said earlier when you introduced me that my interest in gender and in women's studies works its way into the book. I'm glad you noticed that, because gallantry was really invented by women, as was much of many of the ideas about love. Gallantry is an extension of courtly love, but with an important difference. Courtly love insists on lifetime devotion and two people, whereas gallantry can be a series of love affairs, usually for the man. And the focus then moves more from sentiment and lifelong commitment to serial affairs. So gallantry, by the time of the 17th century at the court of Louis XIV, is something that one can speak of positively for men. You can call a man galant, and that's an advantage. Une femme galante, well, I don't know. She might be something of an outlandish woman or something that she wouldn't want to claim. By the 18th century, gallantry focuses more and more on sex. And so you have this contrast between gallantry with its emphasis on sex and sentimental love with its emphasis on the heart or emotion.
We're speaking with Marilyn Yalom about her book, How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance. Because I happen to live in Racine, Wisconsin, I have this sort of strange extra interest in the writer Racine, and Molière, whom you explore in Chapter 3. And as you talk about their work, one of the points you make almost in passing is worth mentioning briefly. Most French people were still illiterate during the 17th century. I think a lot of us, as we dip our toe into these interesting matters, often don't stop to realize that all of this wonderful literature being created at this time was still being created for a relatively narrow slice of the population. There's something kind of poignant about that.
Yes, but I do point out that even those who were illiterate could go to the theater. And that was true in England as it was true in France. And the pit, what we today would call the orchestra, was in fact the place where the poorer people could come. And what did they see on the stage? They saw indeed Racine, and they saw indeed Molière being the comic aspect of love, and Racine the tragic aspect of love. And the upper classes would sit in the loges. So you had one vehicle for people who were illiterate, as well as for those in the upper classes who could read. Most of them could read. They couldn't all write, but they certainly could at least read. When I say write, they could, you know, write fairly well, but some of them didn't really learn to write in the way that we would find as acceptable today. The interesting thing also is this idea of gallantry filtered into society, even into the provinces. And Molière, of course, makes fun of the provincials who come up to Paris and who think that they're going to find romantic love, gallant love, adventure, such as they have read in novels, because novels at that time were beginning to circulate. They became even more important in the 18th century. But between theater and novels and what were the equivalent of newspapers, you began to have a culture that was forming its ideas from writers.
One of the points you make in attending a performance of Racine's Phèdre in the year 2010, you were really worried about how this was going to be received, that the audience might not be prepared to really take in what you call sort of two leaps back to court life under Louis the 14th, and then a second leap back to ancient Greece, since that's where this story originates. And in fact, that audience of modern times sat there absolutely transfixed.
Yes, I was going to say that it was a marvelous experience at our San Francisco ACT Theater, and I did worry about the translation, both linguistically and also culturally, to the contemporary moment. But, you know, emotions exist from culture to culture, and the idea of an older woman who falls in love with her stepson, well, that carries into the contemporary moment. We certainly today, with our blended families, can understand how an older person, man or woman, might indeed fall in love, fall passionately in love with someone who is now a part of his or her family. And we have known the tragic results of incestual attempts and even relationships in some of these blended families. Usually in the United States, it's the man and the stepdaughter. But the emotions of a woman who falls in love with her stepson certainly carried with the American audience that I saw. It was a marvelous performance, and it reminded us that literature from the past, whether it's French 17th century or ancient Greece, can still be extremely meaningful and powerful today.
And later in that chapter, you talk about the tension between collective beliefs and an individual's erotic longings that we find in so many French plays and films and novels. I suppose that's a tension that plays out in many different cultures, but so many French writers seem to have a very effective way of exploring that tension.
They do indeed. The contrast between the individual desires and what the church or what society is telling you is a major, major subject in French history and in French literature. I should say that certain novels which are known worldwide, whether it's Madame Bovary or plays like Cyrano de Bergerac, which is the most performed French play in the world, they bring up these desires of the individual that go counter to society, or in the case of Cyrano, counter to his own physical appearance. He has a physical appearance with that elongated nose that is not going to set him up as an attractive lover. That's the part that Christian plays. But inside, internally, he has the heart and he has the vocabulary of a lover. And so he ends up wooing Roxanne for Christian and sacrificing his own love for her. But of course, all of us who are neo-romantics, we identify with him and with his desires, his longing, his romantic streak. And I think that even in today's cynical world, when you see that play, it's hard not to be moved, and moved even to tears at the end.
Mm. There's two things I want to make sure that I have a chance to ask you about, but I want to mention that all kinds of great works are explored, like Madame Bovary, in very, very interesting detail. One development in French writing that is very easy to misunderstand is this whole notion of, I believe in French it would be sensibilité, sensibility, because the connotation that with which we tend to use that word, I don't think lines up all that closely with what in fact this term means in this context.
Sensibility is one's emotional life, and it is the mark of an extraordinary person. In the 18th century with Rousseau and others, and even beforehand, one was proud of being emotional. Emotions were thought of as being your truer self. And so the man or woman of sensibility was lauded, praised, and thought morally superior to other human beings. And if you couldn't feel, then somehow you were defective.
So sensibility is not about sticking to the facts and being reasonable. Sensibility, the way this term is being used, is all about being in touch with your feelings.
We might say today compassion. Compassion is a word that we use more and more, and we give it a moral connotation. Well, the French give sensibility a moral connotation.
I also want to have us just touch briefly on this chapter called Love Letters, in which you write about the fascinating love letters of a certain woman, Julie de L'Espinasse. Because, of course, I think most of us thinking about this topic without looking at your book would never stop to think that this would be an area worth exploring. Letters never intended to be shared with the public, but of course, in this particular case, what we read and what we find there is extraordinary.
Letters were the major means of communication in the 17th and 18th and 19th century, long before telephone, texting, the whole works. And so if you want to be in touch with members of your family, a friend, or a lover, this was your way of letting those people know what you felt, what you were doing, and arranging meetings. Now, letters were, in a sense, sacred. People saved them. And that's why we have these treasure troves of letters from the 18th century. If you had a group of letters from a woman or a man and they were compromising in any way, the right thing to do was to return those letters after the relationship had cooled. Or in the case of Julie de Lespinasse, she asked that her letters be burned. And most of them were. But this collection to one of the two, well, actually three lovers she had in her life, were saved. And they were published after her death and after the death of her lover by her lover's wife, because Julie de Lespinasse was a well-known figure among the Enlightenment members of the 18th century. And these letters are extraordinary. You really know what it is to be a woman who gives all for love when you read these letters.
It's incredible. I knew nothing of her or these letters until I read your book. And, of course, your book goes on into the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century, including very interesting exploration of love between two men, love between two women, and other ways in which love has been explored and celebrated, and the joys and the sorrows which it has yielded. It's a fascinating journey you take us on. Again, the book called How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance. Now a paperback from Harper Perennial. Marilyn Yalom, thank you so much for writing such a fascinating book. I am so glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show.
And thank you so much for appreciating it and understanding it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Max Clow's profoundly interesting and important book called Race and Social Change. And on Friday, Dr. Samuel Myers, co-editor of an important book about the well-being of our planet called Planetary Health. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. And don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackandrea.com. Please make a note of a very special event this Friday evening, an online concert beginning at 8 p.m. with Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Concert in solidarity with Kenosha. Uptown, downtown, one town. A special benefit concert.